Religious scholar Karen Armstrong is the author of many books on religious affairs, including A History of God, The Battle for God, Holy War, Islam, Buddha, and the Great Transformation, as well as two memoirs, Through the Narrow Gate and The Spiral Staircase. She is an ambassador for the UN Alliance of Civilizations and is currently working on a major international project to propagate a charter for compassion, created online by the general public and crafted by leading thinkers in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Her latest book, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence, examines how religion has and has not contributed to violence over human history. It's a great pleasure to welcome Karen Armstrong to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm very happy to be with you.
What's led you to look at these fields of blood, to look at the subject of religion when it comes to the history of violence?
We are seeing quite a lot of religiously articulated violence in our time. And since 9/11, I've been very much involved in talking about these issues for obvious reasons. But I've been, the more I've gone into it, the clearer it's become to me that even though religion is certainly implicated in a lot of this stuff, it's never the only, nor indeed the chief reason. There are always other factors involved in any kind of war, military historians tell us, territorial, geographical, and above all economic, the desire for this competition for scarce resources. Terrorist experts tell us that whatever the ideology of lies behind an atrocity, be it religious or communist, it is always inherently and inescapably political. It's about power. And we must take these other factors into account if we're to see our situation in this very troubled world accurately.
Why do you think that the view is so often reduced to a soundbite, which is that religion is violent by nature?
This is central to our secularized consciousness in the West. It's been called the myth of religious violence, and it developed after the 16th and 17th so-called wars of religion in Europe. At that time, Europeans were developing absolutist states in which the church had to be made subject to the monarch. And the new ideology promoted by people such as John Locke was that religion had been entirely responsible for the wars of religion. They were caused entirely by the theological quarrels of the Reformation. But if that had been so, we wouldn't ever have expected to see Protestants and Catholics fighting on the same side during these conflicts. But in fact, they often did so, and therefore killed and fought their co-religionists. Secularization, the separation of church and state, has been very important to us in the West. It's been very valuable to us, and it's enabled our modernization process. But it was an entirely new innovation. Before that time, religion permeated all aspects of life, including politics. Every state ideology before the 18th century in every part of the world was infused with religion, and trying to take religion out of politics would have been like trying to take the gin out of a cocktail. Mm. But in our world, we have now that myth of religious violence. It's been called the founding myth of the modern industrial state.
So with that analogy, it still seems like it's pretty tough to take the gin out of the cocktail, though, isn't it?
It is. And in many parts of the world who haven't had our kind of modernization, it seems nonsensical to take politics and religion apart. Because the prophets of Israel, for example, had very hard words for those people who said their prayers punctiliously, but neglected the plight of the poor and the oppressed. The Quran has the same message, because the plight of the poor and suffering and vulnerable, these are matters of sacred import. This is very difficult. No other culture has anything like our modern understanding of religion as an essentially private quest, separate from other activities, centering on a supernatural God with a clearly defined set of beliefs and practices. The only faith tradition that does approach this modern notion of religion is Protestant Christianity, which was itself a product of the early modern period, just like our modern perception of religion.
And we can talk about the personal and we can talk about the organized. So when it comes down to the individual who may be committing a violent act in their mind in the name of religion, that certainly can have economic and political overtones. But for that individual, if we are to take what they say at face value, it is because of their faith.
Well, not really. When I was a nun as a young woman and tried all my for 7 years to do everything purely for God. But I found it was absolutely impossible because human motivation is so complex that we all do things for very mixed reasons. And people have made careful studies, for example, of suicide bombing. And Robert Pape of the University of Chicago has made a study of every single suicide bombing that has occurred between 1980 and 2004 in every part of the world, and concluded that really it has very little, if possibly nothing, to do with religion. Suicide bombing was invented by the Tamil Tigers, who had no time for religion at all. In Lebanon, there were 30-odd suicide bombing attacks during the 1980s. Only 7 of these were committed by Muslims, 3 by Christians, and all the rest by socialist and secular Baathists from Syria. So Robert Pape says that the dominant motif behind a suicide attack has often been the invasion of the homeland by a militarily superior power. And that accounts for the suicide bombings of Hamas before Hamas abandoned this practice in 2005. And if you look at the martyr videos of those young people who committed those acts for Hamas, you see the cocktail at work. They begin very often with calling upon the name of God, and then they segue into nationalism, a secular nationalism that had no roots in the Middle East and no roots in Islam, calling for the liberation of their homeland, of Palestine. Then they segue into a third world ideology, saying that their action will be a beacon of hope for all the oppressed peoples of the world, then back to Allah, then back to nationalism, segueing quite unselfconsciously between all these motifs.
So the individual who then becomes involved and brought to that point of committing the violent act, it is not in a religious setting. It is the people around them have, as you mentioned, motive. The motive then is political and not religious.
Political, and religion is certainly implicated in it, if they're going to sort of use or abuse religion for that purpose. But there have been extensive studies taken of all the people involved in the 9/11 atrocity, as well as the sort of more lone wolf occurrences that have happened since. And they found that only a small percentage, 20% of the people involved in these terrorist activities, had a regular Muslim upbringing. The rest, the vast majority, were either converts, like the recent Canadian gunner who attacked the Canadian Parliament, or they were not observant, like the Boston Marathon bombers, or they were self-taught. Many of them didn't really start to study the Quran seriously until they got into prison. 2 young men who left England in May to join the jihad in Syria had ordered 2 books from Amazon. One was Islam for Dummies, the other was the Quran for Dummies. The findings of these surveys have shown that the predominant motive behind this such a decision is often a sense of meaninglessness in life. A sense that was particularly evident in the Hamas suicides, where life was grim in the Gaza refugee camps, and a desire to give meaning to your life by dying a heroic death. Last month, I was talking to one of our leading military historians in Britain, and he said to me that one of the main motives that drives young men to war has been boredom. A stifling sense of boredom. Chris Hedges, the New York Times war correspondent, has written a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Men particularly often get a kind of exhilaration in battle, a huge adrenaline rush. And as Hedges says, only when we're in the midst of battle does the absolute triviality of ordinary civilian life become painfully apparent.
So that idea of religion does not poison everything, that everything poisons religion, brings the question as to what impact is this having on religion, if that's the rap that it's being given.
Religion does lots of different things. While we are sort of banging on about how violent it is, we've neglected the fact that right from the very earliest days of civilization, it was poets, prophets, sages, mystics of various hues who were the only nonviolent show on town, who promoted the golden rule. Every single one of the major world faiths has insisted that the golden rule, do not impose on others what you yourself do not desire, is the bedrock of ethics and the test of true spirituality. And this rule was evolved by people such as Confucius, Hillel in the Jewish tradition, Jesus, the Prophet Muhammad. They were all living in violent societies like our own, where warfare and violence had reached an unprecedented crescendo. And they said, unless we treat all peoples, whoever we are, even the foreigner, even the stranger, even the enemy, as we would wish to be treated ourselves, we're not going to have a viable world. And I'm very much myself convinced that unless now we implement the golden rule globally so that we ensure that all peoples, whoever they are treated as we would wish to be treated, the world will not be a viable place politically. We're seeing so much alienation and disquiet. If we British had observed the golden rule in our colonies during our imperial days, I'm convinced we wouldn't be having so many political problems today.
How much of it comes to understanding? I mean, one of the things that I found most fascinating about your book is how you spell out and you talk about different religions and specifically address their relationship and non-relationship to violence. And I learned quite a bit about various faiths, various religions, and the belief practices. So how do you get that message out, certainly even for your own religion, if you participate in one, but also for other religions, because it really has to do with that understanding and trust, right?
Yes, and realizing perhaps that how little we know.
Right.
We're quite an omniscient society these days. You know, we can get a lot of information at the click of a mouse on our computers. People hold forth quite dogmatically on such matters as Islam, for example, when you're listening to them, they really don't know very much. I think Socrates said that the true wisdom lay in realizing how little we know. And I think we've got to empty our mind, perhaps, of our certainties, as what Socrates said we should do, is sort of challenge every one of our received opinions or most dearly held certainties, and try to see things in the spirit of the golden rule from somebody else's point of view. I think we need to learn much more, perhaps in the schools too, about other cultures and also about our relationship with other cultures. Because when we look at troubles going on now, right now in the Middle East, for example, it's not just their struggles over there. It's our struggles, too, because both our countries, Britain and the United States, have been active in these regions and have helped be one of the major factors in creating this mess. So our histories are now tremendously intertwined. In fact, the nation state, with its concentration on the welfare of the nation or one's own particular country, is not necessarily helping us to realize that we are now absolutely interrelated globally. We've created a global market that is so powerful that when stocks fall in one part of the world, markets plummet all around the globe that day. So interconnected are our various economies. What happens is happening in the Middle East right now has already had a blowback political effect in Canada and will probably have in more Western countries because we have helped to create the situation in which the Islamic State has come about. We all face the same environmental catastrophe. And so I think it's essential that we realize that we've got to find out about what is happening in other parts of the world, what are the not just rely on the sound bites we get in the news, but try to realize the complexity of everything that is going on. And that demands a certain humility and a certain intellectual humility. We don't know everything.
And I can't stop thinking in reading the book and at its conclusion that that's a really tall order. And I guess I ask you the question of whether you agree with that assessment. And also that if so, where does your optimism lie of there becoming that separation?
What separation are you talking about?
A separation of our understanding of religion and violence.
I'm not so much optimistic as filled with dread. Because the more I look at our world, the more I see violence erupting. I see the massive discrepancy in all our countries and globally between rich and poor, this massive inequality of power, which is causing a huge anger now and unrest. And the more I fear for the next generation, I fear that we're creating an unviable world, and that the future of our species, now that we have weapons of such extraordinary capacity, the future of our species depends upon us learning to coexist. We don't have to fall into one another's arms or even like each other particularly, but I think we have to cultivate a greater respect, because if we don't, I really fear for the future.
Fields of Blood is the new book, Religion and the History of Violence, that is published by Knopf. Karen Armstrong, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, Karen Armstrong's new book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.